This is my father's story. I am the self-appointed vessel and orchestrator who commingles his stories and my memories and memories from my siblings to tell his life story.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Janice F. Kearney about her memoir, Sundays with TJ, 100 Years of Memories on Varner Road, a journey with her 107-year-old father, born in 1906, just 40 years after slavery, in the town of Lake Village, Arkansas.
Thomas TJ Kearney was the storyteller, and I the rememberer of his words, even his unspoken meanings.
So let's take an unforgettable journey through TJ's life as narrated by his daughter, Janice Kearney, on Arts and Letters. But first, news. Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Janice F. Kearney, who recounts and recalls her 107-year-old father TJ's oral history growing up in Arkansas.
How long, baby, how long has an evening train been gone? How long, baby, how long?
So let's wander down Varner Road, ride the rails, work as a sharecropper, and maybe even figure out the magical secret to longevity. As Arts and Letters takes an unforgettable journey through TJ's life, whose only regrets were the people he didn't meet, the places he never visited, if he only had more time.
I sat then at the foot of my father's chair as he smoked his Pall Mall cigarettes and set his eyes on days long past, and regaled us with his strange, amazing yesterdays. Sometimes he weaved in others' tales, Harry, his mother, Cynthia, and certainly his beloved Papa.
Janice Kearney, publisher, memoirist, daughter, welcome.
Thank you.
So you say that writing your father's story was a lifelong mission, which had its embryonic stirrings in your first memoir. How did Sundays with TJ come to fruition?
Actually, Sundays with TJ was kind of a part of me before Cotton Hill Dreams. I talk about how I fell in love with writing and with stories at my father's knee. And I knew probably by the time I was 6 or 7 or 8 that I was going to write his story, because he had mesmerized us all those years with his exciting life, and I wanted to write that story and share it with others.
Let's talk for a moment about TC, TJ's father. They lived in Lake Village. What manner of town was Lake Village, which sat just inside the Louisiana line?
It was a bustling southern town, Delta town. There were rich farmers there, but there was certainly that separation of the races.
How long? How long, baby, how long?
The blacks there were either farmers or sharecroppers, or they worked on the river boats, or somewhere on the ports. But it was very exciting. My dad and his brothers grew up just very, very excited about seeing the steamboats and being able to watch the men working on the river.
Let's listen to Janice Kearney recall the words of her father, TJ Kearney, from her father's point of view.
I couldn't have been more than 3 or 4, but I remember sitting watching the boats as they docked on the river out near Macon Lake. It was my first time seeing a black man working on the boat. I guess I never imagined that black folk could work on a riverboat, and seeing that was really exciting to me. I think I pretty much made up my mind then and there that I would one day work on a boat.
Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in the deep blue sea.
While I was standing there watching, a bale of cotton fell from the boat onto the river, and the black man jumped in the river after it. He climbed on top of the cotton bale while the other crew workers threw out a hook to pull the cotton back onto the boat.
Fishing after me, fishing after me. Fishing.
I didn't know it then, but for the white farmers, that was the same as dropping a whole lot of dollar bills into the water. The river was a really busy place back then, and a strange place.
TJ was not yet 5 years old when his parents moved from Chico County to Lincoln County, right outside the small town of Grady, Arkansas.
Here, the Mississippi, Round River, and Long River, all roughly 5 miles on the outskirts of Grady, provided a great deal of enjoyment.
Well, I'm going, sure enough going, baby, your crying won't make me stay.
You write, more than once, TC moved his family late at night, or during the morning if things did not work out with the landowner. So tell us a little bit about TC.
Yeah, TC was obviously a wonderful father. My father talked about him a lot and wanted to be like he was, how he treated his family. He loved his family a great deal. But he also was a proud man, obviously. And as a sharecropper, he would leave the tenant owner, the landowner, sometimes at night if things didn't work out.
Well, I'm a railroad reporter, baby. You know I wipes out my trail.
If there was some words between him and the landowner, if he saw that he was going to be treated a certain way, he would leave. And
so often he'd pack them up late at night or early in the morning,
he
and off they'd go without probably any.
Exactly. He did. He piled his young children, their old and new house goods, their few cows, pigs, and horses, and Cynthia on the wagon pulled by his beloved gray mare.
Hey.
Most black men in southeast Arkansas during this time worked manual labor around town as farmhands or as sharecroppers. Some worked on the steamboats or the river ports. A handful owned the land outright. TC accepted his fate as a laborer on his or others' land.
Hey.
TJ had many addresses home before the pivotal age of 11. And though as a child he was not privy to the reasoning for his parents' continuous moves, in adulthood he would understand. The moves represented the harsh reality of being black in the South, and who his father was, a proud man who worked hard but refused to work for men who treated him as anything less.
Oh, I'm a railroad reporter, and you know my wife's out my trail.
TJ's father was just 46 years old when he died, as did TJ's sister, Avivius, at 17. Those were pretty striking moments for him. They were they were devastating.
They were devastating. He loved his sister very, very much. Even though she was older than him, he always thought of her as his baby sister. He'd have to catch himself.
Oh, my faith is gone. Oh, my faith is gone. Help me, Jesus, I need some peace.
So she was just very beloved by everybody in the family. And, of course, his father was everything to him.
Oh, my faith is gone. Oh, my faith is gone. And I cannot feel the tears on my cheeks.
And I think with their death, with the flu in 1918, I think that changed his life completely. He couldn't imagine himself remaining at home, even though he loved his mother. I don't think that connection was there, even though at 11 years old, I wouldn't have had the courage to do it, but somehow he had the courage to just leave home and start traveling the world. TJ's transformation from a child came far too soon. At 11 years old, his wandering spirit began. He was not exactly sure what he was searching for in his years of travel, except to see and experience the world.
So I can imagine as a young girl, these were kind of the exciting tales.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Putting on his traveling shoes, traveling the seas, strange train rides, and a drifter's life. Mm. Which of the stories did you want to hear again and again?
I always like to hear the story about the train ride when the boy turned out to be a girl.
When I first thought the whole born boy, I took a freight train.
I guess one of the things that outdone me most during all the years of my life traveling on trains was a ride from Wheeling, Virginia to New York City. I rode with a fella all the way from Wheeling, talking about all kinds of things, telling salty jokes and laughing, then even falling asleep side by side before I learned the truth about him. I remember waking up when the conductor hollered out we were in New York. The other fellow was already woke and over in the corner changing clothes. I didn't say anything, but thought that was kind of strange because most train hoppers don't change clothes when they make it into a new town. I had already made notice that though he was hoboing, just like me, he was wearing a brand new set of overalls. Most hobos don't have the money to buy new sets of clothes. Well, just before we jumped off the train, he slipped off his overalls and cap, and lo and behold, he turned out to be a she. A beautiful girl with hair down her back. She laughed and said, "I bet things would have been different if you knew I was a girl. I was just outdone." And she knew it. Just as she jumped down, she kissed me and said she hoped we'd meet again. I wondered for a long time about that girl, why she was jumping trains, where she was going, and whether she ever made it back home. Like I said, God was always looking out for me, but life could be dangerous out there, especially for a girl.
I took a freight train to be my friend. Down the road I'm going.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll return to Sundays with TJ in a moment. Let's return to Arts and Letters and Janice Kearney as she recounts her father TJ's stories as he hobos his way through America's 1920s.
I did the biggest part of my traveling in the 1920s, and looking back, that wasn't an easy time for a black boy or young man to be moving around in all different parts of the country. Harry was my traveling partner sometime, but most of my travels I did by myself. I didn't know if I was just plain crazy or a fool, but I wasn't scared of much of anything back then, just always interested in knowing what I might find at my next stop. Now I know there was a lot of dangers out there, and I was just blessed. God was just looking out for me, even when I wasn't looking out for myself. When I think back now on some of the things I did without thinking, I get scared just remembering. There were lots of racism back then. A lot of whites just didn't like colored folk. In a lot of places, it wasn't much better than it had been when we were just slaves. I ended up traveling to places not giving it a second thought about whether there were black folks there. Some places I ended up in, the white folk had never seen blacks before and came right out and asked me if I was black. Some places, they'd stare at me like I was from another planet. They were more scared of me than I was of them. There were a few times when I had been walking a while and was thirsty. Men would run me off their places without giving me a cup of water. When I think back on that now, it's still puzzling how you can see a person thirsty and wouldn't give them water, whether it's a stranger or not. I wonder sometimes why I didn't give race problems more thought back then. As hard as the traveling life sometimes was, I also loved it, in a way. I met people, went places, and learned things I never would have if I just stayed down home. But when it was time to give all that up, I knew that too. Somehow, God found a way to let me know when it was time to put all that moving around aside and to get back home and settle down.
His oath is covenant and his blood supports me in a whelming flood.
You wrote that nothing prepared him for what he found on his return to Arkansas in the spring of 1927. What did he find?
He found water. All he could see was water, covering everything that he remembered. There was nothing that he remembered that was in sight. It was just water and people, men, trying to stem it, trying to stem the dams, overflowing. And it wasn't at all what he expected. He'd heard that it was raining and, you know, there was a lot of rain down there, but nobody had told him that it was flooding the way it was.
On Christ the solid rock I'll stand, all of the ground is sinking sand, all of the ground is sinking sand.
The River of Life, as Minnie called it, meant so many different things to the Kearney family and to many other families in the region. The thought that it would change from life-giving to a destroyer of lives, that it would turn angry or vengeful when Arkansas most needed its mercy, was the last thing that most Arkansans believed. TJ had been away for months this time when he returned to Arkansas to find the world he knew so drastically changed.
If I had possession over Judgment Day,
let's listen as Janice Kearney shares another story from her father, TJ's, perspective.
I thought I'd seen just about everything, but when catastrophes like that hit, you might see some of anything happening. I saw some of the strangest and most terrible things during that flood and heard stories just as bad. People were living up in the top of the trees. One woman had a baby up in the tree, and the baby fell into the water and drowned. Nothing could be done. People were risking their own lives to save their cattle and pets. The gin house, about a mile away from the stockade, was filled with people. We heard there was a Mexican woman who had a baby upstairs in the seed house at the gin. I don't know how many people were there. Some people was living in the rafters of farmers' barns with the hogs and horses and cattle. The animal that were still living was keeping up terrible squealing for their lives. Others, the ones already drowned, just floated in the water.
If I had possession over Judgment Day, if I had possession over Judgment Day.
I can't rightly remember when it was, but it was somewhere near the time of the flood that I saw this 7-year-old boy preaching. I swear if that boy didn't preach like he had done it all his life. Somebody handed him a chair to stand up on so everybody could see him. It was prophesizing and talking about the flood and what it meant, whooping and hollering better than any preacher I'd ever seen. I never saw nothing like that in my life. I'd never thought of preaching. Didn't even belong to a church at that time. But for some reason, that boy made me think about changing my life and even maybe preaching one day. Yeah, I think that flood brought out all kinds of strange things. People were scared for their lives. Some swore the flood was God's curse and we were heading for the end of the world. So a child preaching wasn't no more strange than a lot of other things people did after the flood. I never was able to sit still in one place for a long time or stay inside when there was a whole bunch going on. While we stayed at the stockade, I would walk outside and smoke and just look around. For as far as I could see, there was nothing but water. I don't think I ever saw anything scarier than that in my life. I dreamed about that flood for years and would always wake up scared.
So he spent most of his young life moving from one town to another, from city to states, and even countries, jumping and riding the freight trains when the spirit hit him, and seeing things he would later share with his family, and especially his children. One Christmas dream, though, changed his life.
One Christmas
dream. Tell us about that.
Yeah. That is one of the stories that he loved to tell, and now every one of his children can tell that story, and we do. We've shared it with our own children, but it's how he met my mom. And this was in 1936, and he had come home. He had definitely come home at this point and said God had said it's time. And he got sick on Christmas Eve and had a really bad fever. So in the midst of that fever, he had this dream, this really deep dream about this girl that he met at the bus station. And it was this beautiful girl with this beautiful smile, and she looked at him and said, "Take my suitcase," and called his name, and he said, "I don't know you, who are you?" And she laughed and said, "I'm your wife." And he said, "But I don't have a wife." And she said, "You're my husband."
Beautiful.
And she kept walking, and he just followed her. And he kept asking, "Who are you?" But he woke up before he found out who she was. So that was the dream. And he, on Christmas Day, he woke up and was getting better. But he was trying to figure out who in the world this girl was. So on New Year's Day, his cousin came down. He was all better, and he was up and about. And his cousin was getting ready to do a hog killing, which was a big deal in the country. You do a hog killing and it becomes a community gathering. And he asked him if he wanted to come down, and he did. And he still wasn't up to 100%. So his cousin said, "Go in the house and, you know, rest." He went in the house and he saw this girl. First, he saw a girl sticking her head up. And he said, "She looks familiar," but that was it. Then he went inside the house, and there was this girl who was in his dreams. He remembered everything about her. First, he looked at her feet and the shoes that he remembered from the dream. He went into the bedroom where everybody used to put their coats. He found the coat that she had worn in the dream. And he came back out, and he knew this was what God had sent him back.
Beautiful angel dream. Kissed by God and gave up your wings. Came to earth to make me smile. And I've been happy like a child.
He asked her out for a date that night, and the rest is history. 3 months later, they married.
J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's return to Janice Kearney at Sundays with TJ.
And I'm calling, Savior. Yeah. Oh, Savior.
1936 would be TJ's lucky year, the year he would find what he believed was the kind of happiness only possible with God's blessing. Mm-hmm. 1936 would be the dawn of his transformation from a man with no place to call home to a home that offered him all the things he'd experienced only in short bursts throughout his life. TJ and Ethel Kearney were what many in the olden days would call a God fit.
Hear my humble cry. And while on others thou art called holy.
On March 17th, 1937, he's 30 years old, and he marries Ethel Virginia Curry, but she's somewhat sheltered, mm-hmm. right? So as much as this is a kind of a dream come true, mm-hmm. he must have had a few little battles to fight.
Right.
Because he had been a vagabond and running all over the country. Tell us a little bit about that.
My mother came from kind of a different background, if there was such a thing as a middle class black family at that time in the Delta. My mother came from that. Her parents educated their children mostly, and they farmed their own land, and they owned quite a bit. So she was quite sheltered. Even though she'd had a child by then, she was still considered quite sheltered. So she was visiting her cousin when she met James.
Do not pass me.
And the difference, I'm sure, is something that kind of brought them together. I'm sure my mother saw him as something completely different from anybody she'd ever met and kind of fell for him because of that.
Please don't pass me by.
Her parents were not pleased and did not condone the wedding and did not attend the wedding, even though they, you know, the weather was really bad. And I heard that that might have been one of the problems, but they did not think James T.J. Kearney was good for their daughter.
In fact, their expectations were so dire that they persuaded Ethel to leave her 2-year-old son with them.
Yes, yes.
To raise.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't mm-hmm. think it was going to work out.
No, they didn't. No amount of wealth could ever equal the value of what TJ and Ethel gave their children over the next 30 years and beyond. Life's obstacles, impoverishment or not, the two could not fathom lives without each other and without their 19 children. While they did not choose to become the last existing sharecroppers in Lincoln County, they accepted their fates once the wheel that was their life began its orbit. They chose to rely on God's wisdom instead of their own and asked for guidance in their lives as husband and wife and as parents.
So 19 children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about growing up with 19 children.
Well, the first thing I have to tell most people is that we weren't all in the house at one time. That is one of the first questions I get. Well, how many rooms did you have for 19 children? Actually, I can remember as many as 10 of us being in the house at the same time. And my dad, when he built his own home, he did build 8 rooms, which was enough for us. Life was fun. We were very competitive. I'm not sure whether my parents kind of instilled that in us, but we were competitive. Very faith-filled home. Religion was very central to our home. My parents spent a lot of time with us as far as learning, even though the older children had to spend time out of school to actually work the farm. When they went back to school, they were expected to do just as well as anybody else because my father and mother did spend time with us learning. By the time most of us went to school, we could spell, we could read, we could write, we could count because my father made sure of that. He started teaching us very early.
It's tight like that. I don't care how I do it, honey, it's tight like that.
So even though we worked hard and we were very, very poor, they made sure that we had the basics of the things that we were going to need later on, because I don't think either of my parents expected us to be sharecroppers. as adults. So they prepared us for a different kind of life.
And he was the last existing sharecropper in Lincoln County.
As far as we know, right. He was. And certainly there was no one else with 19 children who many of us had to spend time chopping and picking cotton when we should have been in school, probably.
You're listening to Arts and Letters and Sundays with TJ. We'll be back after this. Let's return to 107-year-old TJ's remarkable story and his life on Varner Road, as told by his daughter, writer Janice F. Kearney. Okay, so let's talk about that first home. He built it by hand with some of his children.
Yeah.
Kind of reluctantly, I think, the way he wrote it.
That was probably one of the proudest moments in his life. That was something that he wanted desperately, to own his own place, to have his own land. So by hook or crook, they were able to buy 2 acres of land. And my father built the house that I lived in most of my life on those 2 acres on Varner Road.
Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. That makes me know there's a heaven somewhere.
The funny thing is that when he needed lumber and didn't have the money to buy lumber, he started taking lumber from the house we were living in as he built the home that we were going to move into.
The son scared the door in and knocked in well. Oh, God got the key and you can't get it.
So he was using every little bit of resources that he could. But the home was definitely one of his proud moments. And he always talked about, he had promised my mom that she would have her home before Christmas that year. And she did.
This home was on Varner Road.
It was on Varner Road.
And give me a little of the timeline, because it's 107 years.
Yes,
So we're about, how old is he at this point?
At this point, it was about 1962. So my dad was in his 50s. His mid to late 50s.
And he'd been married about 25 years.
Our lives as sharecroppers were just poverty. I remember that, but we grew up not thinking of poverty very much. We knew that we had to get up and work every morning, especially in the summers. That's what our summers were. We had to make sure that Dad got his cotton crop completed the first half of the summer. The second half of the summer, we were hired out. We would go and chop cotton or chop soybeans, whatever, for someone else so that we could make money for our school and we could help my parents as well. So we would keep half of it for our school and the other half we gave to mom and dad to help them out. So that was our lives and we accepted that. We knew that other people looked at us differently, that they considered us very, very poor, but that wasn't something that we thought of very often. We had a very close family, close-knit family. Our parents never let us think about what we didn't have. They just made us know what our responsibilities were and what they expected of us. That sense of expectation is what I always tell people. I think that is probably the key to having success in any family, when children know that parents have this great expectation for you. So I guess that's why when I look back on my childhood and my life on Varner Road, it's never in a victimized sense, because everything that I am and everything that I've been able to do started then, when they started instilling all these things in us. People will ask me often, how did they do it with all these children? How did they do it? And I laughingly sometimes say, I think these two people went in their bedroom and cried.
And I'm calling, save.
You know, ran it, and then they prayed and they asked God to just guide them, because they may have bitten off more than they could chew having all these children, but because they believed in God and they believed that God loved them, they were guided by that. They were guided by that. There was a wisdom. There was a deep wisdom in how do you produce people who are going to be something later on, even though you're starting out with nothing.
So did you see your father a lot? You worked together, I guess, side by side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But he must have worked.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they always say from cane to cane.
Oh, yeah. They both did. My mother did, too. And my mother was having children off and on just about every year. My mother had children for 30 years. But when she wasn't having her child within the month or so after, she would return to the fields. But she worked side by side with my dad. And then she did the housework and cooked and cleaned and all of that.
The home sat directly on Verner Road, 5 miles west of Highway 65, in the opposite direction of Cummins Prison Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong turn and you'll be eating mashed potatoes with the men in white, some of the visitors would joke. Was the prison farm kind of a constant?
It was a constant. I write about in my first book how the memory of those men in white as we rode down Verner Road on our way to school or coming from school, they'd be on either side of the road. Thousands of men in those white uniforms. And they would be really close to the bus. And sometimes the bus would slow down and they'd be waving and speaking to us and talking to us. But that was sort of a horrifying memory that I have of Cummins Prison Farm. And then later I would learn of some of the atrocities that were going on at Cummins Prison Farm. And of course I remember that most of the men were black men in all these white uniforms. And the white men were up on the horses with the guns. And that was just a memory that just stayed with me.
We're speaking with Arkansas author Janice F. Kearney about her book, Sundays with TJ. Let's hear her again recount the words of her father, TJ.
We sat in at the first sight of spring, planting our truck garden on our 2 acres. That was something Ethel really loved. It was something about her getting out there in the garden, planting, then caring for our plants to make sure they grew. Then later, those she didn't cook during the summer, fresh from the garden, she'd canned and froze for the winter. We always made a good garden, even when our cotton crop didn't do so well. Ethel's canning and freezing vegetables and fruit saved us many a year when we didn't have 2 dimes to rub together. Our house on Verner Road meant a whole lot for a whole lot of reasons. Most of our children grew up in that house. Our older children would come back for holidays, and we'd enjoy our Christmas and Thanksgiving dinners there. It was where the family gathered most Sundays for dinner once they were grown with families of their own. We had a big family, but it was never too many to love. I think the most important thing was that it was the last house me and Ethel lived in together. For all those reasons, that house on Verner Road would always mean a lot to me.
Well, the moon jumped right out of the sky. It bounced in that grove so bright, so high. We all went bouncing behind, singing play it died.
Mother was famous for her canning,
mm-hmm.
peach pies, and
mm-hmm.
apple pies, and every
yes.
vegetable. Tell us a little about your mom.
My mom was just amazing. She was really the center of our home. Dad was a free thinker. He was the creative type. He loved reading and all of that. My mom was extremely intelligent, but she was a more stoic, no-nonsense person. She was focused, targeted. She knew what she wanted. She knew what she expected. So she really was like the center stone for the family. All of her children absolutely adored her. Absolutely adored her. I was extremely close to her. I grew close to her as I got older. And I guess the hardest part was when she started getting sick. I was 11th grade, I think. And I've written about that transformation for me, seeing my mother, who I thought was bigger than the world, get sick with cancer. and actually having to help take care of her with that cancer. But gratefully, she bounced back, and for 10 years, she was an amazing mother. And she and my dad started doing things that they hadn't done. And all those years they were raising us, they started traveling and doing a lot of things together until the cancer returned.
One glad morning when this life is over, fly away.
So her passing in 1982 must have been devastating, too.
It was devastating.
When I die, hallelujah, by and by, oh, I'll fly.
My dad, who's always been very strong, went through probably a couple of years of really just trying to get back on his feet after losing my mom, because they were so close. I mean, they were like one unit, basically, and he depended so much on her.
Shoot, letter this morning, why do you reckon it rain? It said her.
And people saw one, they expected to see the other. So he had lost his soulmate, really. And it was hard for him. And there were times even, which blew me away, that he didn't go to church.
I got up this morning, fella, the break of day. I was hurting the pillow where she used to lay.
After Mom passed, it took him a long time to just get back in the saddle and keep on with his life. He finally realized he had to, and he did. But it was a big blow for him.
Well, some people say the blues is the worst feeling they ever had. Well, now, it's the worst old feeling, me, my mama, my sister, my brother, and my cousin, that we most of never had.
But the whole journey of talking with him and learning new things about him, even as he was into his 102, 3, 4 years old, was just amazing and so heartfelt.
At the end, he did have to move out of the house.
He did. And he was torn between moving and not moving, because that was home and that was where he and Ethel had raised their children. But there were a lot of things. He was getting older. Mm-hmm. And there were people who were coming through, and he didn't know who they were, and there were just things happening. So we decided that, of course, you can't live out on Varner Road, much as you love it, alone. There was no one within 6 or 7 miles of him at that time.
But how long, how long, baby, how long?
When you read these stories, he was so optimistic.
He was.
How did he stay so optimistic, do you think? It was just a part of his nature?
I think that was part of his nature. Yeah. He always said, you get up the morning after. Whatever's happened, you get up the morning after. Either make it better or to change your life in some kind of way. So I think that's what he woke up every morning to do.
I'm the one who loves you. Swear your dreams will come. Beyond the pale blue northwest sky.
I noticed at the end that you had written this and he still hadn't passed away. And then there
right.
was a shift.
Right.
And I left the world tonight to prove our love could never die. I crossed through hell to get to heaven.
I am Janice Faye Kearney, and I will always remember the perfect dawns of June, July, and August, broken by the muted crunch of gravel and rocks as we braved the chill of those summer mornings, our silent trek into Daddy's cotton field, into the damp, cold dew, blanketing every living or dead thing, soaking our bodies, our clothing, chilling us to the bone for just a short time before the scorching sun burned us dry. I remember the strange and perfect choreography of my family's age-old dance, TJ and his children holding the chopping hoe straight and tight as we stretched ourselves toward the delicate cotton plant, our universal focus, ridding Daddy's 40 acres of any hint of wayward grass. Varner Road, an imprint, a mental tattoo in my memory cells, the grossly imperfect gravel road that flooded each time it rained and merited only a perfunctory annual grading, yet insinuates itself into my most treasured memories of my childhood life.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
When what seemed like forever came to an end, so began our barefoot walk home on the hot, sharp, but somehow soothing gravel and rocks. Tired, sated, hoarding our secret dreams, happy for the freedom to dream. Like Daddy, I was a dreamer, dreaming of tomorrow when I wouldn't walk half asleep and barefoot down the cotton rows at 6 a.m, when Mama would wake me an hour before time for the school bus, before heating my bath water on the wood stove to half whisper that today I would stay out to help Daddy make his bail. It is because I am one of 19 children that I have never understood the emotion of loneliness. Older and younger siblings, as many as 10, taking up room in the house. Loud and competitive and oh so heartless, detecting your weakness and bearing down until you cried uncle. Oh, how I hated each of them in turn, loved each of them and all of them ferociously and unconditionally because they were a part of the imperfection and awesomeness that was my childhood, that was anchored by TJ and Ethel out on Varner Road. Thank you, TJ Kearney, for a lifetime of memories and for transforming your family's reality into miracles.
Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. That makes me know there's a heaven somewhere, heaven somewhere.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Also, check out the supplemental section of the webpage for this show. Thank you to musicians Marcus Mookie Cartwright.
Up above my head, I hear music in the air. Up above my head, I hear music in the air. That lets me know there's a heaven somewhere, heaven somewhere.
Samuel Calvin Brown.
Well, the moon jumped right out of the sky. It bounced in that grove so bright, so high.
Amos Cochran, featuring Rick Indell and Ralph D. Cooper. Jock Courtney. Randall Shreve.
Beautiful. Ain't
angel dream. Kissed by God and gave up your wings.
Alex Carr. Samantha Harnsberry. And Shea Floyd.
Glad morning, when this life is over.
Who supplied the music for today's show. Thank you to the amazing Mr. Chris Hickey, whose extraordinary talent helps us produce these shows. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Janice Kearney, who shared the oral history of her father, TJ, and wrote Sundays with TJ to ensure his life and his story is remembered by those who need it most. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's be mindful of the words of Eudora Welty. Long before I wrote stories, I listened for stories. Listening for them is more acute than listening to them.